Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative reporter Jason Leopold, who examines why he believes Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is now seeking the indictment of Deputy White House Chief of Staff Karl Rove. Michael Zweig, professor of economics at the State University of New York, who examines the relationship between America's newly mobilized immigrant community and the labor movement. And Lexi Schultz, of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who discusses the Bush administration's political manipulation of federal government science. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The London-based Independent newspaper reports the World Bank is being accused of breaking a pledge to fight malaria in Africa. In late April, 13 medical specialists blasted the World Bank, which has a $20 billion annual budget, of slashing its malaria staff to zero and promoting clinically obsolete treatments. The doctors are seeking an independent audit of the bank program called Rollback Malaria, and a shift of $1 billion in World Bank funds to the UN Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. In 2000, 53 African leaders pledged to cut malaria deaths in half by the year 2010, and the World Bank promised to spend $300 million to fight malaria in Africa. So far, less than half that amount has been spent. In its defense, the World Bank admits the malaria program was understaffed and underfunded, but rejects the charge it has broken promises or hidden funds. The World Health Organization says 3,000 children die from malaria every day. The doctors maintain had a physician or a pharmacist behaved as the bank did, they would have been condemned or possibly sued for medical malpractice. With the retail price of gasoline surging past $3 a gallon, President George W. Bush gave the red carpet treatment to Ilham Aliyev, president of Azerbaijan, a powerful oil state in the volatile Caucasus region. The former Soviet republic of 8 million people shares a 380-mile border with Islamic Iran and is seen as a buffer against Russia's growing influence in the oil and natural gas market. President Aliyev will soon benefit from a windfall of petrodollars from the recently completed Baku to Turkey oil pipeline, which will bring 1 million barrels of oil a day onto the international market. The White House visit is of concern to human rights and anti-corruption groups who have long criticized Azerbaijan's government. As Human Rights Watch observed, Azerbaijan has a long history of unfair and corrupt elections and using politically motivated arrests to silence critics and opposition politicians. According to the Associated Press, the Bush administration is also courting two emerging oil states with poor human rights records, Kazakhstan and Equatorial Guinea. The Washington Post reports an Ohio coalition of Christian and Jewish clergy has filed two complaints with the Internal Revenue Service against two conservative churches, the World Harvest Church and the Fairfield Christian Church, for actively supporting the candidacy of Republican J. Kenneth Blackwell, the current Secretary of State, who is running for governor. A complaint filed in January accused the two churches and affiliated groups of permitting Republican organizations to use their facilities and illegally promoting Blackwell's candidacy, who in 2004 backed an Ohio ban on same-sex marriage. A new complaint filed in April states that the churches invited Blackwell to church-sponsored rallies and other events while not inviting any other candidate. Blackwell has also used a plane owned by World Harvest Church for trips. The IRS says 75% of the cases they've investigated have resulted in legal action, including a case against the liberal All Saints Church in Pasadena, California, for sermons against the Iraq War and attacks on social conservatives in the weeks prior to the 2004 election. In response to the complaints, Reverend Russell Johnson of the Fairfield Christian Church, who also heads the Ohio Restoration Project, called it spiritual warfare. Reverend Eric Williams, a United Church of Christ minister who signed the complaints, noted it's time for these churches to stop acting like electioneering organizations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
President Bush's senior counselor, Karl Rove, testified for 3.5 hours before a federal grand jury on April 26th. The political strategist's appearance was part of the continuing investigation by special prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald into who in the White House leaked the name of covert CIA agent Valerie Plame in an effort to discredit her husband, Joseph Wilson, who challenged the president's rationale for the Iraq War. Just 1 week before he made his fifth appearance before the grand jury, Rove lost his position as Mr. Bush's chief policy coordinator in a White House shakeup. Sources close to the investigation have told reporters that Fitzgerald is now seeking an indictment of Rove for perjury committed in previous grand jury testimony and lying to investigators. Rove withdrew his original denials that he had no conversations with reporters concerning the identity of Valerie Plame after he learned that Time magazine's Matt Cooper would testify that he was a source for his Time story on Plame. In early April, Fitzgerald filed court documents revealing that indicted former Chief of Staff to Vice President Louis Libby testified that Dick Cheney had told him that President Bush personally authorized the release of classified intelligence in July 2003 to refute critics of his administration's rationale for war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with investigative reporter Jason Leopold, who explains why he believes Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is now seeking the indictment of Karl Rove.
I reported that Karl Rove is, quote-unquote, a target of the investigation, that the Special Prosecutor has informed his attorney that there's enough evidence to link Karl Rove to a crime. His attorney denies it, and that's fine, but his attorney has also become part of the investigation. He's a witness in his own right. You know, I'm not accusing his attorney of lying. I'm just saying I have sources that are giving me other additional information. So this is, right now, this is a situation where we have to see what happens. We have to see what is going to eventually unfold. And from what I have been told, what is ultimately going to come down is that Karl Rove is going to be indicted. I also want to provide the reality here. Anything can happen at the very last minute. We're talking about a high-profile criminal case. And in all types of cases like this that involve crimes, you know, a suspect, if you will, could very well, you know, try to make a plea deal at the last minute. And I won't, and that could happen in this case. It very well could. Until the grand jury actually votes to indict, that's when it happens. But at this point, with Karl Rove not trying to get a plea deal, what we have is perjury and lying to FBI investigators. There's a possibility, it's very likely that he will also be indicted for obstruction of justice. When he was first questioned about the case in October 2003, specifically how he found out about Valerie Plame Wilson, the covert CIA operative, and whether he shared that information with people in the media. Now, Karl Rove testified that he only shared information about Valerie Plame after he read about her in a newspaper report. Well, evidence has surfaced that, in fact, that is not the case. He was a source for Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper. And in addition to that, there have been emails, specifically an email that Karl Rove had sent to then-Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley shortly after his conversation with this Time magazine reporter, basically giving him an update on what they spoke about. And what they spoke about was Valerie Plame's husband, who at the time was a very vocal critic of the administration's pre-war Iraq intelligence. His name is Joseph Wilson, the former ambassador. There is no doubt that Karl Rove is in legal jeopardy. It's right now, it's a matter of when the hammer will fall, when he will find out.
There is some concern at the White House, from what I hear, that President Bush and Vice President Cheney could themselves be in jeopardy for having a hand in the campaign to discredit Joseph Wilson through the revelation of his wife's identity as a covert CIA agent.
That's absolutely correct. And the fascinating thing about this case is that how much more information will be revealed in the months ahead. And Scooter Libby's team, defense team, has already put out the warning that they will call the vice president and the president to testify. If anything, they have made it abundantly clear that they are not going to fall on their sword, or he is not going to fall on a sword at this point, that he is going to take everyone down with him. And what we're about to see, I think, will be quite revealing and explosive. It may, in fact, confirm what we've already suspected, but it will be shocking nonetheless to find out that the president was in the know.
Well, I guess, Jason, I want to ask you the million-dollar question. Is the Bush presidency in jeopardy from this case? And if so, why?
Let's face it. You know, by the time Libby comes to trial, and perhaps if the grand jury does, in fact, vote to indict Rove, the Bush presidency may, in fact, be winding down. I think that ultimately, when all the facts do come out, you know, the history will be rewritten in terms of the Bush presidency. However, if we start learning more about this case, you know, come next January, or at least if the court filings provide more information, this definitely will be a failed presidency. And I cannot see how this president will get any of initiatives passed, because what will happen is that I think that the American people are just going to be so fed up. And hopefully the Democrats, you know, will have some sort of message, some sort of unified message, where they can take back one of the houses or both of the houses and really promise to investigate this. And I think that's ultimately how it will be a failure. If we learn, you know, the president, what did he know and when did he know it, and if we get the answer to that question before November, look out, because this is, I do believe that the Democrats will call for an investigation, and there could possibly even be impeachment proceedings. I don't see how that they can get away with it.
That was investigative journalist Jason Leopold. Read his articles online at truthout.org. Leopold's just published book is titled News Junkie. The mobilization of hundreds of thousands of immigrants and their allies in over 200 cities around the U.S. on May 1st marked another historic moment in the rising consciousness and action of this once marginalized segment of the nation's population. Large numbers of immigrants participated in marches, rallies, boycotts, skipping school or work in what was billed as a day without immigrants. While Latinos comprise the largest number of participants, thousands of immigrants from the Caribbean, Asia, and Europe also joined in the day's activities. The driving force behind the outpouring of activism in the immigrant community was the passage of legislation in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives that would criminalize the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. and those who assist them. Negotiations over less draconian immigration reform proposals that could lead to legalization are pending in the Senate. The immigration protests coincided with May Day, the international workers' holiday born out of the struggle for an 8-hour workday, the 1886 Chicago Haymarket bombing, and the subsequent hanging of four activists. In recent years, unions in the U.S. have been drawing closer to the struggle for immigrant rights, not least because these millions of unorganized workers could help provide new members to a labor movement that has been on the decline over the last three decades. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Zweig, professor of economics at the State University of New York, Stony Brook, and director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life. Zweig examines the relationship between America's newly mobilized immigrant community and the labor movement.
Well, I think that we have a real mark that's been made this year, starting in April, with the demonstrations that were in Los Angeles and also in Dallas and all over the country, North Carolina, Ohio, Chicago, Milwaukee, in New York earlier in April, and now this May 1st thing all over the country again. It's very plain and very clear that we have a very large and mobilized immigrant population which seeks fair and decent treatment at work and seeks fair treatment before the law. And I think it's going to be difficult for Congress to pass legislation which criminalizes these millions and millions of people and converts them into felons, and converts anyone who gives them any help or service also into criminals. I think that we're seeing a social movement here that is going to have a very profound effect on the law.
It seems that the AFL-CIO and organized labor have changed their position in recent years to immigrants, trying to embrace them rather than seeing them as a threat. You want to make a comment on that?
Well, I think that that is right. From the beginning of the AFL, American Federation of Labor, as a confederation, a collection of trade unions, mainly in the skilled trades and crafts, beginning actually back in 1886, at the same time as the Haymarket events that gave us May Day, the AFL unions have been traditionally very much focused on the interests of their own members and have been characterized by a lot of racism, a lot of sexism, and a lot of nativism and anti-immigrant feelings. And those sentiments, particularly the sentiments against immigrant labor, have been characteristic of American unions up until really just about the year 2000, just about 5 or 6 years ago, when the AFL-CIO finally figured out that immigrant labor are working people and need to be organized and need to have the same rights that every other worker has, regardless of their immigration status, because the entire working population, the entire working class of America needs those rights, and you can't defend those rights for some workers and disregard them for other workers. So in the last 5 or 6 years, the American labor movement has really turned around 180 degrees and has become pretty much a full-throated proponent of immigrant labor rights. And I think we've seen that in events like the Immigrant Freedom Ride that was organized by the unions in this country about 3 years ago, where thousands and thousands of immigrant workers from all over the country came to New York City in caravans that came all across the country and had rallies in cities everywhere they went. So that was the first real public organizing step that the labor movement took, were those freedom rides. And what we see now is a continuation of that, but driven not just by unions, but by immigrant labor organizations that are not unions, but do represent immigrant labor.
As we have this outpouring of immigrants' rights activists all over this country on May Day, the traditional workers' holiday, do you think that the mobilization of immigrants around the current issues in Congress will later on to improve the fortunes of organized labor, of labor unions who've been losing membership over the last 20, 30 years?
American labor movement is very much on the defensive and has been losing members. One impetus for them, for the unions to take an interest in immigrant workers is the obvious point that if you're going to organize workers and immigrants are the workers, those are the people you're going to be organizing, and you have to pay attention, and you have to really be internal and integrated with and supportive of immigrant labor. So I think that as we see these immigrant workers from Latin America, from China, from Eastern Europe, from Poland, out marching and out organizing as workers, and with the support and with the resources devoted to it by regular unions too, that it can only help to turn the organizing campaigns around in industries where these workers are, where we find them. So I think we see, for example, the Service Employees and Union is doing a lot of work organizing immigrants. The restaurant workers and the hotel workers doing a lot of work organizing immigrants. The laborers, a lot of work organizing on construction sites all over the country, and here in New York as well, and in Connecticut. So I think we do see a convergence here of interests and of energy, and I think that there may be in it an element of a turnaround as working people increasingly take to the streets and take to more militant and more class-wide actions to defend their interests.
That was Michael Zweig, professor of economics at the State University of New York and director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life. Learn more about the immigrant rights movement by visiting immigrantsolidarity.org. In the latest of many decisions that put politics ahead of science, the Bush administration's Food and Drug Administration in mid-April issued a ruling that no sound scientific studies support the medical use of marijuana. This contradicts a 1999 report issued by the Institute of Medicine, a part of the National Academy of Sciences, which is the nation's most prestigious scientific advisory body. That review found marijuana to be useful for treating nausea and vomiting from chemotherapy used in cancer treatment and for reducing the wasting impact of AIDS. 11 states have legalized the medicinal use of marijuana, but the Drug Enforcement Administration and the director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy have opposed those laws. Other issues where science has collided with the Bush administration's right-wing ideology include downplaying the existence of climate change, calling on scientists to alter their data to show that mercury pollution is less damaging to health than scientific studies originally showed, and concerns around reproductive health. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Lexi Schultz, Washington representative for scientific integrity at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She compares President Bush's manipulation of science to that of previous administrations and explains what UCS and other groups are doing to help restore scientific integrity to policymaking.
It's clear that political interference in science has become pervasive within this administration. Across a broad array of agencies on a large number of issues, when the science is not supported, this administration's predetermined policy agenda, the administration has chosen to manipulate, suppress, censor, distort scientific information. We've heard from scientists and advisors to past administrations, both Republican and Democratic, that this interference in science, while not brand new, is certainly happening at an unprecedented level and across an unprecedented number of issues. Politics has been allowed to interfere with science on issues that affect us all. One of the biggest environmental topics has been global warming. And there have been a number of different cases where the administration has chosen to either suppress scientific information or to try to distort it so that it appears that the science around global warming is uncertain, and in so doing, to try to reduce the urgency of the need to take action. And all of this fits the administration's policy agenda of not taking immediate action on global warming.
In addition to environmental issues, another area where this manipulation of science seems to be prevalent is in the arena of health, like the example we saw most recently regarding medical marijuana, and specifically in the area of women's reproductive health, and even more specifically in the holding up of the availability of emergency contraception.
The Food and Drug Administration ignored not one but two different science advisory panels that were looking at the question of whether it was safe to sell emergency contraception, so-called Plan B, over-the-counter, and then whether, in fact, the government should make this drug available over-the-counter. And the scientists said that this drug is extremely safe, and the FDA not only ignored the scientists on the panel, but then came out with their own pseudoscientific reason for denying approval to the drug. They said that there was no evidence that the drug wouldn't affect young girls differently than other women. But in fact, there's never been any studies that this drug should have an impact different on young children. And they came up with this totally on their own. And what they're trying to do here is distort scientific information in order to justify their reasoning.
Lexi Schultz, your organization is called the Union of Concerned Scientists. So as concerned scientists, what are you doing to raise the alarm about this issue?
Well, absolutely. The Union of Concerned Scientists has an entire program on scientific integrity, and we're working both to raise awareness about the problem and about the impacts of the problem for all of our lives, because, of course, these decisions are not happening in a vacuum. We've issued two reports about different examples of political interference in science. And we released, along with one of these reports, a statement that had been signed by 62 very prominent scientists, including Nobel laureates. This was back in 2004, calling for a restoration of scientific integrity and policymaking. That statement has now been signed by more than 9,000 scientists. One of the other things we're doing is trying to survey scientists within federal agencies anonymously so that scientists who are feeling this kind of pressure or intimidation can make their voices better heard. Overall, the picture that's being shown is that these scientists definitely are feeling a chilling effect. Many of them are extremely proud of the scientific work that they are doing, but they feel that political interference in science is hampering the ability of the agencies to do their jobs. And that's extremely troubling. And it's troubling also because these agencies may be losing the best and brightest scientists. There have already been a number of people who have resigned. And it's going to be extremely hard for the U.S. to retain its world leadership in science if we continue with this type of abuse. But we are very interested in solutions. We have been working with an array of science-based groups, of watchdog advocacy groups. It's also true that the National Academy of Sciences came out with a report where they specifically decried the practice of asking science advisors, these are people who serve on science advisory committees, questions such as, did you vote for President Bush, or do you support this particular president's policies? There are two bills. There's a House bill and a Senate bill, both of which are called Restoring Scientific Integrity, that would at least fix part of the problem. The bills right now have a number of co-sponsors, but they have not been given hearings. And certainly, these are bills that deserve hearings. So we hope to advance those in the future.
That was Lexi Schultz, Washington representative for scientific integrity at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the group by calling area code 202-223-6133. Or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.